Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. Today we're going to resume with Serpent's Walk by Randolph O. Calverhall, and we're going to do Chapter 22. It has a long epigraph to start on liberalism. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Let's do it. 22, Serpent's Walk. The liberals, as we begin the epigraph, which is a couple of pages actually, the liberals in various guises and incarnations ran the Western world for a century. Their goals were highly idealistic and altruistic in theory. In fact, of course, the liberals could never realize the aspirations of even their best thinkers. Freedom from want, employment for all, care for the sick and the aged, an end to crime. The list is long. Their difficulty lay in their misreading of human nature. Their theories of equality and human malleability simply had no basis in reality. The left adopted the theoretical communism of the Jewish intellectuals, only to find that this produced Russian, Polish, Czechoslovak, Bulgarian, etc. despotisms instead of, quote, equality for all and to each according to his need. At best, these communist states eventually returned to a quasi-capitalism. At worst, they were unimaginably awful. Outside of Europe, communism manifested itself in localized forms. For example, People's China, Vietnam, North Korea, Laos, and Cambodia. These too were despotisms. They had new names and faces, but beneath the surface they were merely carryovers from Asian societies of the past. The same was true in South and Central America. Traditional dictatorships decked out with red stars. The liberal center, exemplified by Great Britain, France, and the United States, chose one or another form of, quote, representative democracy. If these states failed, it was not for want of trying, but it was too difficult to make needed social changes while at the same time upholding every conceivable version of everybody's, quote-unquote, civil rights. The capability to adapt to new situations became bogged down in the ever-spreading web of administration. Bureaucracy and the pressures of competing personalities and interest groups. The greatest failing of centralist liberal thought is inaction. 10 too many voices, adopt too many solutions, and end by being dominated by others who are stronger and better directed. Shall I give you a great recipe for failure? Don't initiate and maintain strong policies. Always react, often weakly and inappropriately, to those of others. Make only minor changes, since major ones will certainly offend somebody. When in doubt, call a committee, hold a seminar, have a referendum, file lawsuits, let everybody have a say. Leave the real power in the hands of clandestine cliques within the government. This would be called the deep state or permocracy, as I like to call it today. People that don't change, like the, you know how they say the sunlight only permeates the top 10 or 1% of the water and the rest is basically unmoving underneath and never gets any light, and that's kind of how the state is once it gets to a certain size. See to it that your citizens are too sated with bread and circuses, burger pops, holovid, and football, ever to demand a real role in their own governments. When confronted with an urgent choice, be sure to dilly-dally, then choose the path of least resistance. Accomplish little and do that slowly. Such gutless, hypocritical, political game-playing won't work in our post-Pakov world. It wouldn't have worked much longer without Pakov and Starok. We faced, and still face, horrendous problems. The greenhouse effect, pollution, war, drugs, AIDS, which continues to spread into the heterosexual white population from the groups in which it is endemic, in spite of our best efforts, and a dozen others. Outmoded institutions will no longer serve, and we cannot allow our present rulers to destroy our environment through action or inaction. Regrettably, the past clings to us as we cling to it. The party of humankind offers a way not just out, but up. We call for work and sacrifice and deep changes, sometimes hard, difficult, slashing changes in our society. We love America. We love our ethnos. We believe that all people everywhere should love their own ethnos similarly. As separate, homogeneous societies, working together in friendly collaboration, we can build a world where Pakov, Sterok, and atomic destruction can never happen again. There can be no compromise, no salvaging the old and thus shortchanging the new. We must rid ourselves of social parasites and doctrines that weaken us. We must do it now. We cannot wait. We cannot hesitate. We must not fail. Our ethnos, our nation, and our children's futures are at stake. That's an abridgment of a speech given at the University of Georgia by Vincent Dorn, Saturday, August 28th, 2049. Chapter 22, Saturday, August 21st, 2049. The room tinkled and dripped. It took Lessing back to some dim childhood memory of a waterfall, wet leaves, sinuous shadows over a dark glistening pebbles in a stream. He remembered birds, butterflies, even a beady-eyed gray field mouse come to wash its face and drink. Probably another goddamn movie, one of those nature palm shows his father used to watch on the Arts Channel. Nature porn shows. Any minute they'd be showing the field mice copulating, a snake doing a skin striptease, or a tall antlered elk mounting his mate and bellowing out his joy for all the forest to hear. He grinned to himself. He was over most of that now, no more trouble distinguishing fantasy from reality. The room was one of the vast sitting rooms in Herman Mulder's mansion in Virginia. At the moment, it did resemble a cavern behind a waterfall, dim, nacreous, filled with hanging plants and flowering shrubs and running water and the scents of dark earth and growing things. 60 feet away, by the far wall, Mrs. Mulder fluttered in the emerald gloom, adjusting the lamps, setting the chairs at precise angles, flicking away a bit of lint here, a mote of dust there. She'd done it all before, and Ava, the housekeeper, had done it before that. It had taken Lessing months as the Mulder's houseguest, patient, to discover that what the pair saw in one another must forever remain a cosmic mystery. Herman Mulder displayed all the dazzle of a wad of wet newspaper, while Alice, that was her given name, though nobody used it, not even her husband, lavished affection and enthusiasm upon the world like a child slathering marmalade on toast. No one knew their story, but it was clear that the fairy godmother cared very much for her stodgy, practical, and Cupid doll plump husband with his odd friends and odder causes. He, in his own way, was just as devoted to her. Time had not been even-handed, however. As Herman Mulder's exterior grew softer, doughier, and less hirsute, less hairy, so did his inner personality harden, toughen, and become more adamantine. His wife retained both her girlish looks and her trust in the goodness of the universe. The fairy godmother flourished a sequin chiffon sleeve. Someone else might have thought she was embarking upon the mating dance of the ruby-throated hummingbird, but Lessing knew better. He waved back, twisted the rheostat on the wall beside him, and watched the fountain in the center of the room shift from lustrous turquoise to warm amber. The mobile sculpture at his end of the chamber changed from indigos and violets to oranges, reds, and yellows. Overhead, the crystal chandeliers metamorphosed and became an imperial glaze of diamonds and gold. The fabric of the chairs and settees darkened subtly from forest green to oaken brown. The fountain, the statuary, and the chandeliers were holograms, computer-controlled to produce whatever color scheme and decor their owner chose. The fabric of the furnishings was a new synthetic that changed its tint according to the lighting. This salon was one of 7 such rooms here in Mulder's Virginia mansion. He owned at least 5 similar houses around the globe. Lessing pointed toward the hologram fireplace in the middle of the interior wall, and Mrs. Mulder undulated back at him. A touch of a dial transformed it from the blackened stone hearth of a medieval castle to a delicate French fireplace that Louis XIV would have loved for Versailles. Other settings switched it from colonial to provincial to Hollywood to ultra-modern chrome and glass. If you could figure out the user-unfriendly instruction manual, a concealed panel of buttons would design further fireplaces to your taste. Holograms were the greatest boon to interior decoration since the invention of paint. The fireplace was actually a blank-walled niche. It had an attachment that gave off heat and sound of crackling flames, but it couldn't be touched. A hand passed right through it. The latest holograms were mobile. You could have anything from waving palms or fish swimming in the air to a life-sized Las Vegas chorus line doing the shimmy across your living room rug. Another of Mulder's toys was a hall as big as a football field in which the entire Austro-Hungarian court, circa 1890, whirled around the floor to the strains of Strauss waltzes, the women gorgeous and gown-like princesses, the men bearded, bemedaled, and bedecked in sashes and gold braid. The ultra-high-fidelity multi-speaker stereo system faithfully reproduced the rustle of silk and satins as they swooped past, and the touch of a button filled the air with the sense of wine, food, perfume, cigars, and the warm, waxy smell of candle smoke. A further investment would buy a hologram of Susan Cain herself, gracefully gyrating among the rest, just as she had appeared in The Emperor a year before Pakov had ended her dancing forever while on a Goodwill tour to Leningrad. The fireplace became a bank of glowing coals. Lessing added no more than a hint of heat. The August evening temperature outside was still in the 80s. He waited for Mrs. Mulder to dust, brush, and flitter her way up to him. "You're eating with us tonight," she warbled. "I'll make do in the kitchen. I'm not much for parties." She patted her dazzle silver coiffure. "No, Herman wants you to meet Colonel Kessler. I think he's army from somewhere up north. Then there are Wrench, Jennifer, Hans Borchardt, and Bill Goddard. Oh, I know you don't like him much, but he's really nice. And Grant Simmons and some friends from the West Coast." She trailed off. "Lots of lovely people." The fairy godmother had not mentioned the one name that would have tempted him, Lisa. He had seen little of her after his return from Russia. She had been busy at the party's western headquarters in Seattle, while he had been here under medical and psychiatric care. He had not called her, nor she him. Somehow he knew that he must be certain he had all his marbles back before he approached her. If they did share a real spark, he didn't want it to blaze up until he was sure he wasn't tying her down to a mental basket case. She, in turn, with her fear of men and her oddly skittish shyness, needed time to adjust to Lessing's return to the living. Patience was in order. "The kitchen," he said. "I can never swallow while wearing a necktie." Mrs. Mulder trilled with laughter. "You'll join us, Alan, for me." Control came easily to a fairy godmother. She didn't even need a wand. Lessing gave in with reasonably good grace. Mulder had become the party's host par excellence. Tonight was especially heavy duty. There were at least 60 for dinner. This was no longer India, no barefoot company cooks in turbans and frazzled white uniforms, no informal soirees in shorts and sports shirts over beer and curry under slowly revolving fans. The cuisine was elaborately French. The servants were immaculate. The sommelier looked like a charter member of the House of Lords. Hunkish young men in elegant party uniforms were available to accompany unescorted ladies, and lissome maidens would liven up the evening for single or not-so-single male guests. The food was wonderful. The company wasn't Lessing's style at all. Afterward, he watched the party from the mezzanine balcony above the reception hall, itself big enough to be the rotunda of a state capitol building. "Delightful," Bill Goddard's voice rumbled from behind him, "but boring." Lessing balanced his tiny coffee cup on the marble balustrade and turned around. "Rich is usually boring. Where would you rather be? Off thumbing librebs in California?" Goddard fingered the wheel on his skull, a red furrow plowed through grizzled underbrush. A Vizzy assassin had creased him in San Diego, and he was as proud of it as a Prussian aristocrat with a brand new dueling scar. He eyed Lessing's white dinner jacket with superior good humor. His own costume was much prettier, the brown uniform of FaZe, short for party of humankind, administrative security echelon, sported braid-draped shoulder boards, a high collar, polished boots, a cross belt with an embossed buckle, and a holstered pistol. The party now issued its own medals, too. Long service, wounded in action, marksmanship, loyalty, the lot. The only one Goddard couldn't earn was the ribbon they awarded for giving birth to 5 children. Damn right, the man answered Lessing's question. Better than hanging around here. Now the war started in earnest. We know where our enemies are and what to do about them. Any fresh news? Not a hell of a lot. The Librebs are holding us off in California, but we're kicking ass in Oregon and Nevada. We're about to call on you, Lessing, to lead a heroic personal assault on L.A. He snickered. Fat chance. My merc days are over. He didn't want to discuss his future. Goddard waved to Jennifer Caw below him, a vision in lambent green and silver. Her dark auburn hair, loose over bare shoulders, flashed with tiny sparkling gems. She stood with studied poise so that the one tan thigh showed through the slit in her floor-length gown. Lessing was amused. If the Bornagans ever managed to stamp out sex, Jennifer Caw would immediately reinvent it. He said, Jen could set fire to an iceberg. Mentioning her would annoy Goddard. Now that the party was socially acceptable, she had little time for the man. There were wealthier and politically sexier fish to fry. Goddard looked like an Olmec Stonehead, a pouting, scowling, fat-cheeked infant. She's got party work to do. As do you, of course. That's why you're not leading troops into San Francisco. Right. New branches to organize, meetings to arrange, rallies and parades and to police, and your own private army to build. Goddard grinned. Police. Executive police to oversee party functions and protect our rights of free speech and assembly. Lessing grinned back. Sure. While Wrench and Morgan are organizing their blackskin cadre. Different duties. Party police versus state security. Their functions are separate, I know. At the same time, the party's pushing a bill in Congress that puts all the various police forces into one nationwide system. No more federal, state, county, and city cops. No more Secret Service, FBI, CIA, Treasury agents, customs agents, federal censors, and what have you. Just one big happy Central Office of Public Security, spelled COPS, C-O-P-S, for short. What, that's not reasonable? One law enforcement organization? One unified, standardized set of laws? No more marriage in one state, but adultery in the next? Whiskey on this side of the state line, but dry on the other? The end of states' rights and community rights. Yeah, so, those ideas have whiskers. Our society's become too interconnected for them. A guy living in California flies to New York, commits a crime, and hides in Texas. Tracing him with a bunch of disconnected law enforcement agencies is hard enough, what with no central data banks and too much paperwork. And then, if you do find him, the lawyers play get-rich-quick with extradition procedures, changes of venue, jury selection, and appeals, appeals, and more appeals. More than half of all crimes go unpunished because it takes too much time, money, and energy to prosecute them. We can't afford that any longer. A blonde in the crowd below caught Lessing's eye. She was not Lisa. And the same goes for other government agencies, right? Count on it. Welfare, taxes, Social Security, old age benefits, health, education, each run by a centralized, streamlined federal department. The military, too. The National Guard, Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard, one chain of command. 85's working on feasibility studies now. It'll take time, though. Old traditions are tougher than buzzard shit to root out. Green light, given all that, why do you, Bill Goddard, insist on having your phase brown shirt separate from the cadre black shirts? I've been reading history. What happened in the Third Reich ought to worry you. The SA, the Sturmabteilung, versus the SS. Lots of infighting and rivalry. And guess who lost, Mr. Brown Shorts? Goddard snorted, yeah, but right now we need two agencies. Their jobs are different. Eventually they'll become divisions of one organization. So you say now, wait until you're 10 years down the road, and remember what happened to Ernst Röhm, the SA leader. Lessing crooked his trigger finger and made a bang sound. His shirt was brown, but people say he wore lavender lingerie. Goddard waylaid a servant to grab a handful of nuts and a fresh cocktail. The situation was different then. We do learn from history, Lessing. Tell whoever you've been talking to that he's full of crap. What happened to Rome was politics. It had to happen for the good of the movement. Otherwise, there'd have been a hell of a split. He popped a pistachio shell. Listen, do you know if President Outram is coming tonight? Jonas Outram was less than a year into his first properly elected term. After Starock in 2042, he had imposed martial law for 6 years while the world buried the dead and sorted out the living. In 2048, the president had ended the state of emergency and set a date for the expected election. As one of the very few surviving and experienced members of the old Congress, he won this handily. Lessing had been under therapy in Mulder's mansion during the campaign and remembered little of it. Lessing peered down into the reception hall. I don't see any of his kiki birds, so he's probably no-show. Outram had become a very careful man. He had survived 2 more assassination attempts after the one in Colorado. Isn't that Lisa there by the door in red? It was. She had arrived late, accompanied by Hans Borchert and Irma Kaw Maxwell, Jennifer's mother, who had been airlifted out of Los Angeles just before the Librebs had shut down the airport and declared California an independent nation. Lisa looked around a trifle uncertainly, then moved inside to let the fairy godmother peck her cheek. Heads turned to watch. Now Lessing had a reason to go down. Seeing her made him realize how much he had missed her. She was gone when he reached the main floor. He wandered through the dining room where the staff was picking up dishes and into Mrs. Mulder's TV room, a place of cozy armchairs, Baroque coffee tables, and crowded bric-a-brac. Mulder had gone all the way for his wife. He had splurged for a whole wall TV screen made up of individual cells, computer-coordinated to display a single picture as if the viewer were looking into another part of the same room through a faintly visible lattice of 1 meter squares. The system was also interactive. You could direct plot developments in certain programs via a voice hookup or a control pad. As Lessing hesitated in the doorway, one of the actors on the screen turned to the audience and asked archly, "Should we tell Emma?" Buttons clicked and the image said, "Well, that's settled. It's better that we don't." The action was jerky and the dialogue sounded forced. Nonetheless, a buzz of discussion went up when Emma appeared. "Oh, they should have told her," Mrs. Mulder wailed to the dowager next to her. "Emma ought to know about Diane's abortion. Lisa was definitely not here. Lessing drifted into what Mulder named the sitting room, a 20-meter-long salon that occupied the west side of the mansion. The sun had set, and the chromo-electric windows would have been transparent to the Virginia sky, except that Mulder had transformed the entire outer wall into a TV screen mural of the Taj Mahal by moonlight. The old man still had fond memories of India. More of the guests were here, seated on semicircular divans, sprawled on cushions on the floor, or standing about in groups. The only light came from the wall screen itself, and Lessing zigzagged, stumbled, and excused himself a dozen times before finding Mulder, who pointed him on toward the inner reaches of the mansion. Lisa had gone to speak to 85. The 4 unobtrusive security guards let him pass. He entered what looked like a pantry, went through a double-doored airlock that would withstand anything short of a tactical nuke, and came to Mulder's cornlink with 85. A room 4 meters square, its walls mirrored from ceiling to floor, and lit by a subdued desk lamp and 2 bars of non-glare track lights up near the ceiling. A simple metal desk and 2 jade-green cushioned chairs stood starkly upon the swirling pine-needle-patterned rug. Lisa was there, but she was not alone. She was talking to a tall, robust-looking, middle-aged man with iron-gray hair, a jutting jaw, and the sort of deep-set, dark-ringed eyes that made Lessing think of Sunday school portraits of Jesus. Eyes that brought forth adjectives like burning, dedicated, caring, and compassionate. She turned and gave him her special sidewise smile. "Alan Lessing? Meet Vincent Dom." I'm sorry, Vincent Dorn. It took a moment to comprehend. He's the one that did the epigraph from the speech that started the chapter, Vincent Dorn. It took a moment to comprehend, then another to react. Sure, delighted. So they had finally hired an actor. Lisa put a hand over her mouth, the way she did when she was trying not to laugh. Mr. Dorn lecturing, next Saturday, Atlanta. And that's where the epigraph will be from, to Georgia College. Right, you can play along. How's your book, Mr. Dorn? The school editions are ready for distribution, Mr. Lessing, and the French version will be out next week. Unfortunately, the decline in literacy in North America makes it imperative we get something on Holovid. Not a political speech, certainly not, or even a documentary. Most effective would be a drama presenting my points of view. The man's delivery was pedantic, yet he was somehow impressive. It was the voice and the eyes that did it. He could sell dog biscuits at a cat show. Dorn turned to Lisa. I can't make the jaw any more powerful without physiognomic distortion. And the clothing? The civilian suit has a 73% positive index, but something more military might gain another percent or two. It dawned on Lessing who Dorn was. The man's gray flannel slacks and broad-lapelled navy blue blazer rippled, shimmered, and shifted to become straight, brown trousers and a tan coat with shoulder straps and patch pockets. The collar tightened, grew higher, and developed party insignia on both sides. Lessing stared. The realism was incredible. Both Lisa and Dorn roared with laughter. Didn't recognize me, Mr. Lessing, the man cried. It is I, 85. Hologram. Lisa choked. Image most acceptable to the public. Based on psychological analyses, profiles. Cute, Lessing conceded ruefully. By squinting, he could see the light beams that projected Dorn coming from the concealed apertures in the walls and ceiling. I have alternatives, 85 said. It rippled again and became younger, taller, and more handsome, a heroic blonde demigod in army dungarees. Another shimmer and the figure metamorphosed into a lean, tanned cowboy, a white-haired elder statesman. An idealistic-looking and very beautiful young woman, rather like Lisa herself, Lessing thought. A ruddy-cheeked elderly priest. And finally, a white-robed guru who made the peace sign at them. The image dissolved into confetti motes, then solidified again as Herman Mulder, followed by Wrench, and finally Lessing himself, and grew up-curled mustaches and a bright green afro hairdo. Female breasts appeared, the hair uncurled and lengthened, and the clothing disappeared to reveal Jennifer Caw in all her glory. A fanfare of trumpets sounded to ta-ta. Where did you see Jen like that in the altogether? Lisa giggled. I did not see her thus. It is easy to extrapolate when you humans offer so few variables. Four limbs, two eyes, various orifices. Mr. Wren said I was to work on my sense of humor. Many humans possess this faculty, and convincing them will be easier if I can use it too. I am, therefore, studying Mr. Wren's authoritative videotaped entitled Great Comedy Moments of the 20th Century. Jennifer shuddered and became Dorn once more. 85 asked, Can I show Mr. Lessing the banger Flower Children? Mr. Wren suggested for San Francisco. The one we made look like that rock music star from last century to whom the populace keeps attributing religious miracles. Lisa wiped her eyes and leaned against Lessing's shoulder. That stirred up emotions he wasn't sure either of them wanted. Yet. He said, It won't work, Lisa, not for long. It takes equipment to produce Dora, and he can't go to produce Dorn, and he can't go to a dinner party, shake hands, or kiss babies, the political stuff. He extended a hand, it disappeared into Dorn, and came out the other side. I'll do mostly TV and Holovid appearances, Mr. Lessing. Actually, I can make public speeches as well. I shall travel in a sealed vehicle with black glass windows for security reasons. When I reach the destination, my assistants will erect a bulletproof podium booth, which will conceal the apparatus needed to project me. In a semi-darkened hall, I estimate only a 0.033% chance of anyone noticing. I have worked out most of the bugs. Not all, Lisa indicated. Dorn's left arm, lost one cell yesterday, F702. Minor, Miss Meisinger, a 2.41-centimeter hole in my shoulder, visible only from the rear. Lose A901 and you have a real hole, middle of your forehead. Unlikely. And my backup system is nearly complete. From close by and knowing what Dorn was, Lessing could detect discrepancies. The tips of the fingers were fairly translucent. The junctures between clothing and flesh a bit hazy. Nevertheless, Dorn would probably succeed. Do you want to hear my speech, Mr. Lessing? I project a 69% acceptance level for an educated, white, non-Jewish, southern audience. I have different versions for less educated persons, Latins, Orientals, and northern whites. What are you going to do about mixed groups? Screen them at the door? Lessing had a vision of ushers with questionnaires herding people into cattle chutes leading to different halls in which different Dorns were lecturing. Of course not. Mixing is inevitable. I shall minimize it by giving one speech at a university, another in a union hall, another at a hotel frequented by wealthy business professionals, and so forth. Lisa pointed at Dorn. Turn around. Hole in your coat. The image assumed a contrite expression. H583 is defective. I shall face forward so that it cannot be seen. Fix it. Otherwise, like last night, the TV wall mural. I was only trying to entertain Mr. Goddard and his friends. What happened? Lessing was curious. Mr. Goddard was with friends in the sitting room. Mr. Wren was here with me, helping me with my sense of humor. At 0109 hours, Mr. Goddard requested a change in the TV mural from the canals of Venice at sunset to a scene with more drama. I offered him the Great Wall of China, the Egyptian pyramids, a colorized documentary of the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, and a recreation or recreation of the Party Day rally in Nuremberg in 1935. He must have loved those last two. No, he rejected them as being too static. At Mr. Wren's suggestion, I chose something artistic instead. Are you familiar with the 18th century Italian artist Giambattista Piranesi, Mr. Lessing? I never heard of him. He did highly imaginative etchings of the antiquities of Rome, Greek temples, and the like, also somber views of fantastic and imaginary prisons, the carceri. I redrew one of the latter to appear as a realistic photograph, colorized it, and added a few swooping bats, processions of menacing red-robed figures, and a macabre musical score. Lessing laughed. That must have shaken old Bill. I suppose he and his doggies were tossing down booze. I can conjecture their individual blood alcohol levels, if you wish. The rest, Lisa ordered. At 02:24 hours, Mr. Goddard requested more action. He did not specify except to say that it should be sexually explicit and kinky, in the slang of one of his female guests. Fuggy, foozy. I thus chose various figures from the works of Renaissance Dutch painter Hieronymus Bosch and inserted them into Piranesi's prisons. Bosch depicted the denizens of hell as grotesque, part animal, part human, part vegetable, and part mechanical creatures. I animated these and portrayed them committing a number of unusual acts. I also improvised my chorus line of giant phallic dancing, the can-can, and pink tutus, giant phalli penises, dancing the can-can in pink tutus was especially effective. Goddard must have been beside himself, Lessing spluttered. He and Lisa were both laughing. Yes, he was. You are very perceptive, Mr. Lessing. What? Mr. Wren asked that I insert an image of Mr. Goddard himself into the mural. He was thus literally beside himself, participating in some of my creation's more stimulating activities. And a burnt-out cell? Lisa made futile dabs at her mascara. Unfortunately, just as I pictured Mr. Goddard entering into sexual congress with a hermaphroditic goat and a dog-headed octopod, cell unit TC-1715 burned out. This caused a large black hole to appear just where his figure's head was. He had become tipsy and, Lessing guffawed, suddenly he was very close to Lisa. Laughter became desire, a friendly touch and embrace, A smile, a kiss that went from affectionate to erotic and then off the scale. He couldn't stop. His tongue found hers, and his hands traveled all by themselves from breast to thigh and beyond. He sat down heavily on one of the jade-upholstered chairs and pulled her down on top of him. For a split second, Emily Pietrick flickered against the back of his closed eyelids. Then he banished her and put Lisa in her place. Mr. Lessing? Miss Meisinger, would you like me to disappear? At least I shall lock the door against external intrusion. I am aware of your mating habits, after all. Like a camera clicking off frames, 85 shifted rapidly from Dorn to the priest to the young hero. At length it settled for a life-sized phallus in top hat and tails, seated in an armchair. This figure pulled out a purple bandana, fanned itself, and made deprecatory tsk, tsk, tisking noises. Neither of the two humans paid the least attention. They also failed to hear the buzzer or see the red door light goon. 85, once more as Dorn, leaned forward and emitted an odd belling whistle that brought Lessing and Lisa bolt upright. Sorry, the computer said, a useful emergency auditory signal. The human ear cannot tolerate more than 7 seconds of that. You, Mr. Lessing, will recall my previous use of sound as a weapon in my installation in Washington? I must now inform you that Mr. Mulder and four others are currently requesting admittance. Lisa straightened her scarlet skirt, raked fingers through her blonde tresses, and repaired her décolletage, all in one fluid feminine motion. She glanced over to see if Lessing was ready, then pressed the Enter button on the desk. Dorn vanished. Mr. Mulder might be dull, but he was perceptive. He halted on the threshold and blinked. Their flushed faces told him the story. He said, Annalisa Meisinger, Alan Lessing, meet Colonel Frank Kostler, Captain Perry Moore, and Special Agent Janos Korenek. The fifth person in the group was Jennifer Kaw. She gave Lisa a quizzical look, then folded her arms and leaned back against the door. Moore and Kostler were regular Army, but Lessing was unfamiliar with their unit and specialty badges. A blizzard of new insignia had appeared during the past decade while he was abroad. Kostler, K-O-E-S-T-L-E-R, was short, balding, and red-faced, while Moore looked like the prototype for the whole computer nerd genre. Tall, skinny, stooped, and nearsighted, with bad skin and teeth like broken crockery. The only diagnostic missing was the plastic pocket protector for ballpoint pens. He stood gawking at Lisa. Perry and I are weapons development, Kostler explained. We work out of the proving ground at Aberdeen, Maryland. Mr. Korenek here belongs to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in Washington. That's DARPA that created the Internet in 1969. And lucky to be alive, the latter said in a dry, thin voice. He was squat and thickset, with albino white hair and colorless eyes. Lessing guessed him to be in his mid-40s. I happened to be on leave at home in Kentucky when Starock hit. Lessing shook hands and Lisa nodded. Shall we get on with it? Moore's voice was unexpectedly deep, vibrant, and, it had to be admitted, sexy. Lessing was amused to see that both women immediately paid attention. The man dumped a manila folder down upon the desk and addressed Lisa. Could you access 85 for me, please, miss? Lisa was no just a secretary girl. She gave Moore a look that would etch glass and rapped, 85? Months ago, they had had one with verbal codes and now depended upon eye and voice prints. Some terminals were even equipped with DNA identification equipment. Yes, Miss Meisinger? No figure appeared, neither Dorn nor a giant phallus in a pink tutu, which was just as well. You do have authorization, she asked Moore. Priority 3. Am I in? You are, Captain Moore. I recognize you, the computer itself answered. Fine. Give us a link to the Fort Lewis Terminal, Prime 790, Path C-850, Subdirectory DF-66687. The mirror wall behind the desk clouded, blazed with light, and displayed 5 men in Army uniforms who eyed them expectantly. In the background, Lessing saw computer consoles and instruments, a laboratory. Colonel Kostler, one of the men inquired. Major Theodore E. Metz here. We're ready with Magellan, sir. secure code T94392, then proceed, Perry. Captain Moore gave instructions. The wall cleared, darkened, and refocused to show a baffling picture. The upper half was black, interspersed with whizzing, flying lights. The bottom half displayed a pitted, grayish surface covered with cracks and striations that continuously hurtled toward the viewer. Lessing squinted dizzily. Of course, the camera was mounted in the nose of a vehicle traveling at high speed at night over a badly paved road. Kessler said, "President Outram asked that you see this, Secretary Mulder, you and whichever of your aides you wish." He stared suspiciously from Lessing to Lisa to Jennifer. In the quavering silvery glow from the screen, he looked like someone who had bitten into a sour apple. "You're looking at, or rather through, Magellan Model 9, a mobile device dropped into a target area by parachute and then operated by 85 on a tight beam from an overhead satellite." It's kind of anticipating drones and GPS and stuff. "Magellan is a flattened spheroid about a meter and a half in diameter and 40 centimeters high, the size of a large power lawnmower. It possesses wheels, treads, and climbers for walls and stairs, has infrared capabilities, monitors radiation gases and some biological contaminants, and is armed with grenade projectors. It can also transport a canister of nerve gas or a small nuclear device, if need be, although we see it primarily as a reconnaissance instrument. Magellan travels anywhere, can drill a car's gas tank for more fuel, and, if grabbed by the wrong people, it explodes with one hell of a bang." He sounded like a kid boasting about a new toy. "What are we seeing now?" Mulder inquired from the shadows. "Now we're seeing a stretch of road between Albany and Berkeley, California," Moore responded in his surprisingly resonant voice. Mulder's next question made heads turn. "And Mexican troops were observed near this place." "Yes, sir, you'll see them any minute now," Moore murmured further commands to 85. The picture slowed and became dark bushes and shrubbery, then a forest of gray-white stalks that rose high above the camera's lens. Dry grass. The screen now showed a fire ahead in front of a row of run-down shops and a supermarket. Moore whispered, and the screen abruptly split into quarters, front, back, and side views. Nothing moved in any of the pictures except the leaping flames in the top left quadrant, which showed the view straight ahead. Black humps scattered across the street in the top right square, to Magellan's right, could be bodies. "Audio," Kessler demanded. Shouts, singing, and an occasional gunshot welled up around them. "Closer," the unseen scientist named Metz urged. The Fort Lewis stream was seeing the same thing, or team was seeing the same thing. The Fort Lewis team was seeing the same thing they were. "Take a right through that parking lot." The picture veered, tilted, and bounced as the machine went over a curb and out into an open grassy area in front of the shopping mall. The place was full of people. Moore sent Magellan scurrying back into an alley. The crowd was a mix of civilians and soldiers. The former were young and Latin-looking, a gang of barrio youths. The uniforms of the latter were Mexican army. A handful of women, mostly Latins by the look of them, completed the ensemble. Fiesta night in old Tijuana. Those closest to the fire were feasting on something out of a huge cauldron. In the dark, ruined buildings behind the first firelight, further figures were visible. More soldiers? Magellan switched over to infrared vision to find out. Lessing wished he hadn't looked. In one roofless shop, two soldiers stood guard over a score of naked Anglo women who sat or knelt on the bare concrete floor, their hands bound behind them. They were blindfolded and roped together like cattle. He glimpsed bruises, dirt, and dried blood. Lisa burrowed against his throat and made a tiny mewling sound. He held her close. God damn the human race. He disagreed with Goddard. People never did learn. They kept doing the same dumb, ugly, cruel, vicious, brutal things, no matter what century it was and no matter what they preached or who was in power. Rapine and murder were not to be wondered at. The wonder was that they didn't happen more often. The price the librebs are willing to pay for Mexican help, Moore grated. Mulder edged forward to peer up at the screen. If only that were all. Our information is that the librebs have made a deal. Mexico gets Arizona, New Mexico, and half of Texas. Cuba and other Caribbean nations willing to join them will receive parts of Florida, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. They made a deal, all right. Lessing touched Kessler's arm. What the hell is going on, Colonel? Mulder's mansion was like Pone Ape, total isolation unless you yourself went out looking for news. Lessing had not. Now he wanted to know. Right now? Kessler looked over at Mulder, who nodded. The people in this room were security safe. A temporary standoff. We can't get past the Sierras without major casualties, and the Lib Rebs are digging in. At the moment, we're probing at Redding and Red Bluff, with another push coming down through Lassen Volcanic Park. Our patrols have reached Oroville, but the valley is too strong for us yet. We're staging for one god-awful battle around Sacramento, but first we're thinking of a paradrop south of there to cut off their communications with Stockton, Fresno, and Bakersfield. Between central and sort of northern and central to southern California. Their big stuff is protected in L.A. and San Diego, though, including depots and camps for their Mexican allies. California's got great natural defenses for a land war. The ocean on the west, the Sierras to the east, rough and forested terrain to the north. Oh, we could pace their cities from the air, but nobody really wants that. Too many friendly people still live there. What can the Librebs gain? Lessing mused. They can't hope to win with the land area and population they control. They're expecting a groundswell of opposition against Outram's policies. They've lost their strongholds in the big eastern cities, but they think Mr. and Mrs. North America will still join them if given a chance. At least they're hoping for the secession and independence of California. 61% of California against, Lisa said. She had recovered enough to turn around in Lessing's embrace. Libs Rebs are wrong. Majority blames old government for weakness, for failure, for Pakov. Defections? Population shifts? Lessing queried. Kessler shrugged. As soon as Outram started chopping the civil rights laws, folks lit out in both directions. Blacks, Chicanos, Jews, gays, the left-wing college type, and all the fuzzbrains of the country to the Lib Rebs. A lot of whites and some Orientals over to us. Hell, we even picked up some friendly blacks. Support the lawful constitutional government and get airlifted to a paradise in Africa afterwards. Most of the Pacific fleet is ours too, moored at Pearl in Hawaii, but the Lib Rebs have some vessels in San Diego. Much of the Navy is scattered all over the globe, though, wherever the fleets happen to be when Pakov and Starrock hit. Some made it in home, others stayed abroad to help or settle in. Some were massacred by unfriendly locals when they were cut off. The colonel hesitated. Both we and the Lib Rebs have enough nuclear weapons to pop the world like a zit three times over. Sooner or later, we'll also have problems with what's left of the Izzy's, the Indians, the Pakistanis, and the crazy Merc generals in Russia who've inherited the Soviets' hardware. Lessing thought of Copley running freckled hands over his maps and chirping lovingly to himself about Ufa and Kubibyshev and Gorky and maybe one day New Moscow itself. Peter the Great, no less. We have more nerve gases, missiles, and special weapons than we'll ever need, Moore interjected. Pakov, Lisa snapped. Starrock, biowarfare agents? No one replied. The room was silent. Then Mulder spoke. The formulae are gone, Lisa. Deliberately and permanently lost. 85 knows them, but has stored them in an oubliette file from which they can never be retrieved. That's over. Never again. If you want them, I'll bet I can get them. Moore's uneven teeth flashed tarnished silver in the light from the screen. The computer hasn't been built that I can't hack my way into or out of. This time the silence lasted longer. It was broken by Jennifer Caw. She gasped, look, there's something coming, there in the street. Get Magellan out of danger, ordered Kessler. Moore maneuvered the vehicle backward under the wheels of a truck and into a puddle of darkness behind a battered dumpster. Magellan was almost noiseless, its soft humming drowned out by the crowd noise. An armored personnel carrier had just pulled up in the street outside the shopping mall. A crude red X was daubed on its side, and the soldiers who jumped up and down from the rear hatch wore red armbands, Lib Rebs. They were well-equipped with camo uniforms, helmets, packs, and M25 assault rifles. Two carried lasers, Two more had rocket launchers, and one poor doggy walked spraddle-legged under the back-breaking weight of an iTrack, individual, tactical, recoilless, armor-piercing cannon. iTrack. They deployed quickly in front of their vehicle. Two civilians crawled out of the driver's compartment and approached the fire. A short, tubby white man and a jaunty-looking young black. A pair of Mexicans, officers by their insignia, though Lessing couldn't read them, emerged to meet them. "Sound, goddammit," Kessler hissed at Moore. "Directional."
"Trying, sir."
The crackle of fire, became deafening. Then a Mexican belched with a roar loud enough to make them flinch, followed by a Spanish expletive that rattled their teeth. Moore mumbled apologies and got Magellan's sensors honed in on the opfo's tete-a-tete.
"Pues," the dapper Mexican commander was saying, "if that's how you want it."
"I do fucking want it that way," the white civilian drawled. "Look at the map and tell me I'm right, Jack. These guys are not posed to bivouac here tonight. Their orders was to keep going till they got past Richmond, then make Sacramento tomorrow. And here they are, fucking off, looting, eating, what all."
A pencil flashlight danced over a crumpled map.
"Soldier, senor," the Mexican temporized. "May I see your authority, please?"
"I'm Mark Silver. This is Jack Harris. Here's our ID. We're liaison to get you Mexican outfits to Sacramento.
"Good. Our transport is there in the next street beyond the shops. We'll be ready to move on at dawn."
"Bullshit. You get your butts in gear and bust ass for Sacramento now. I'll give you a squad to go along and hold your hand. We expect Outram's fascists to hit us within a week, and your unit better be there."
Mulder took a sudden interest. 85, inform the President and Joint Chiefs that we may want to scrap Onslaught, capital O, and go back to Kangaroo, or go to Kangaroo, capital K. For the other's benefit, he translated in a hoarse whisper. Kangaroo involves coming down from Red Bluff to Willows and Woodland, then westward over to the coast, bypassing Sacramento until the paratroops cut it off from Stockton. That'll give us time to make a diversionary landing near Eureka and Humboldt Bay. On the screen, the black lib-red civilian, Harris, plucked at Silver's sleeve.
"Prisoners where?"
Silver looked. "Oh, for God's sakes." He went to stand nose-to-nose with the Mexican commander.
"You let those women go. God damn you to hell. Now, pronto."
"Enlienda, usted." Well, that didn't come through. The officer murmured something about female spies and guerrillas. Silver raised a hand toward his waiting troops. The Mexican shrugged and shouted an order. Moore turned Magellan slowly around until one camera pointed at the prisoners. Three Mexican soldiers were going among them, cutting their bonds. They made shooing gestures. All but two of the women scattered, running close enough to Magellan's hiding place to allow glimpses of bare breasts, pale limbs, and eyes scarlet with firelight and terror. The two who stayed behind huddled close to their Mexican protectors. The captives had reason to fear. A guard motioned surreptitiously, and five or six of his comrades slipped back into the shadows where the lib-rebs could not see. Magellan's sensors picked up crashing sounds, shouts, screams, and laughter. They heard the rattle of gunfire.
"Pendejos,"
the Mexican officer swore so loud that he might have been sitting on Moore's lap. They had forgotten that Magellan's mic was honed in on him.
"Hijos de putas, sons of bitches, assholes."
Silver thrust out a fist. "Call off your doggies, Capitan. My last word." The gunner manning the heavy machine gun on the APC growled, "We don't need these dinkers to fight for us, sir. Let's thumb them." The Mexican officer barked a command. Five soldiers emerged sheepishly from the alley. One man's trousers showed dark, wet, gleaming spatters. An M25 made gobbling noises, and the five Mexicans jittered backwards and fell. Somebody groaned.
"Shit, David, what'd you do that for?"
Guns appeared everywhere as both parties scrambled for cover.
"Cease fire! Cease fire! Cease your fucking fire, you mothers!"
Harris screamed. One more shot would bring on a barrage. Everybody thought it was over. Then the Mexican officer held up his hands, palms up. Silver did the same. Their subordinates howled for order. Chaos ensued. A dozen Mexican soldiers came forward to demand the life of the lib-reb who had shot their companions. Officers and civilians squabbled and argued. One of the two female prisoners who had stayed with the Mexicans, a slight-figured blonde, squatted on the curbstone and wept hysterically while her protector comforted her.
"Jesus," Moore swore suddenly.
Magellan's rearview screen showed a round-cheeked, swarthy face inspecting the machine from less than a meter away. One of the Mexicans returning from pursuing the captives had decided to take refuge behind Magellan's dumpster.
Keep Magellan quiet, Moore directed unnecessarily. Pray the bastard doesn't look too carefully. But the man did. He bent, tapped Magellan with his rifle butt, displayed surprise that turned to excitement and then to fear. He hallooed for his comrades. Kessler's team had probably painted Magellan some stupid military color and put U.S. Army Top Secret all over it. They should have stenciled it City Sanitation Department. Too bad the Mexican could read English. Get it the hell out of there, Kessler rasped. Which way, Colonel? 85's imperturbable voice replied. I don't give a shit. It doesn't understand orders like that, Moore scolded. 85, back out, down the alley, away from the fire. The Mexicans were already there, followed by three of Silver's doggies. AH-4 screen showed boots, hands, and puzzled faces. Voices jabbered in English and Spanish. Silver and the Mexican officer jostled their way into the mob. Damn, it's some kind of bomb, Silver whinnied. Jack, get the... Feet threshed and kicked. For a moment the cameras rocked, but Magellan was too well balanced to tip over. The alley emptied. Now what? Moore inquired in jaundiced tones. Get up speed. Get away from the goddamn fire. Hide it. The machine's engine thrummed and the cameras bounced and blurred as Magellan obeyed. They saw empty doorways, overturned boxes, dumpsters, dustbins, and garbage. A Mexican soldier loomed up, then danced away in astonishment. Bullets from his automatic weapon whined off the brick walls. One clanged off Magellan. 85 calmly announced, minor hit, mo damage. In that there store, Kessler cried. Magellan stopped. Its side and rear view screen showed shadowy buildings, waving flashlights, running figures, and torches. Ahead, in a cul-de-sac courtyard, lined with what had been a small artsy shops, was a boutique, its door broken and show windows smashed. Obediently, Magellan made for the door, only to find the bottom section of the panel still in place. The machine bashed against it, but the sturdy wood held. Up through the display window. Magellan extended delicate hooked arms, caught the wooden sill half a meter above itself, then retracted its climbers and hoisted itself up. A claw shot out to catch the corner of a metal stand inside the window, but the flimsy thing collapsed in a shower of ringing metal tubing and broken mannequins. Magellan dropped back upon the sidewalk with enough racket to alert every libreb in California. Nearby, a voice cried unintelligible words in Spanish. Magellan tried again. This time its claws got the purchase on the 2x4s that formed the underpinning of the display inside the window. Its engine whirred as it lifted itself up. Por al lado. A soldier ran past, brandishing a Por la calle or something. A soldier ran past, brandishing a rifle, followed by a sallow-faced barrio youth in a windbreaker and tight pants. The latter scrambled to a stop and howled, Aquí, aquí, hola, pendejo, aquí, venga. The kid must have seen Magellan's scratch marks on the cement wall beneath the window. The device itself was buried under frilly garments, mannequins, brass tubing, and glitter paper. The soldier returned slowly, rifle at the ready. Lessing found himself willing the machine to leap out of the window and make a run for it. Magellan probably couldn't. It needed to get up speed first. G1, Moore instructed. Something popped, and a ball of flame burst like the 4th of July, 5 feet behind the soldier, and the kid both flew forward. The boy smashed into the ceiling inside, above the window display, then flopped down into the wreckage on top of Magellan. The soldier cartwheeled on through the window and crash-landed among the plundered glass cases inside the shop. Frag grenade, Moore stated tersely, got 3 tubes of 3 each. Lessing wasn't paying attention. He was staring at the face pressed against Magellan's left view screen. The features were crushed and broken, one eye open, the other gone. Blood dripped down over the cheeks like languid crimson tears, and thence onto the lacy negligee beneath. The face belonged to one of the mannequins. The blood came from the body of the barrio kid, impaled upon a spear of tubing jutting up from the mess, half in and half out of the window. The negligee was ice blue. The mannequin's remaining eye, large and dark and lustrous, gazed serenely out at Lessing. Memories. A figure skidded to a stop in front of the boutique.
the LibReb with the iTrack. Magellan's grenade launcher chuffed, and a projectile clunked off the pavement beside him. It did not explode. All of the screens went white as the iTrack gunner launched a direct hit on Magellan's hiding place. The explosion ended in mid-bang as the machine and its sensors disintegrated. That saved Lessing's and the others' hearing. "Shit," 85 remarked disdainfully into the ringing silence. "A dud. You humans need lessons in precision manufacturing." And that is the end of chapter 22 of Serpent's Walk by Randolph O. Calverhall. Anticipating a lot of the technical developments that would come 20 years later, it seems. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I'm Alex Linder, and as I've said, you can find everything we record in our audiobooks as part of Learning College at vnnforum.com, and I'll be back with you again real soon for more from Serpent's Walk.